This morning, we're once again going to be looking at one of the great sermons from the book of Acts. Up to this time, we've seen sermons from Peter and from Paul. And they've all been sermons given to those that were usually in the synagogue, or as it says, the Jews and the believing Greeks. And they all centered around, of course, the message of Christ. A lot of times he would start off with the prophecies and show the prophecies that had been fulfilled through Jesus, and then Jesus' life itself. We get over to Acts chapter 17, and we have a sermon that's a little bit different. And it's different because of the audience that it's given to. He's not going to be speaking now to believing Jews and the Greeks that knew all the Old Testament prophecies and all the Old Testament scriptures. He's going to be talking to a different type of audience. One, in some ways, more like the audiences we have around us today. If you look over to Acts chapter 17, we have the beginning in verse 16. Paul is of what sometimes called Mars Hill. He's in the NIV, it's the Areopagus. And that simply means the hills of Arius. So the hill Arius is the Greek form of the Greek god Mars. So it's really just the hill of Mars. Look at with me in chapter 16. This is on Paul's missionary journey as he's journeyed all the way through Asia and come now down into Greece. And he now at the great city of Athens. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and great God-fearing Greeks, as well as the marketplace by those who happened to be there. And a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. And some asked him, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. And so they go on to ask him to talk more with them about these things. I want you to look at with the very beginning. It says, while Paul visited Athens. Now, Athens was one of the great cities of that day. In fact, it's still a place that people like to go and visit, see all the great temples. Like the Parthenon and the others had been built by this time. In fact, the Parthenon was standing up until World War II, and now only a few, some of it's still standing even now. And you can still go back and see these great temples they had all over the city. And Paul visited Athens. It says he was greatly distressed. It bothered him that here was a great city of learning. This was the home of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. And many other philosophers that we still read about today. And in this great city, it was covered with idols. In fact, the word actually says it full of, could be, it was covered with idols. And it bothered Paul. Sometimes I wonder in our lives, and when we see the things around us, sometimes we take them too easily. And we don't even let all the things around us bother us the way that perhaps they should. But Paul was in Athens, and he starts discussing this with the Epicureans and the Stoic philosophers. And in many ways, their philosophies are very much what you see around us today. Epicureans believed they saw pleasure in the material things of this world. They saw this world as being all that there is, and that in order to have pleasure, we should seek it in the things of this world. And they sought it in friendships and in knowledge and in food and the other ideas that this world is what we have to live for. The Stoics were a little different. They believed in self-control over emotions and that we could have reason and rational thought. We could control our destinies to some degree, but pretty much that everything was determined in this kind of fatalistic viewpoint. So you had the Epicureans that believed in chance and just pleasure in where we could, and the Stoics that believed in a fatalistic view of life. These were two philosophies that asked Paul to talk to them more. And when we think about the things around us today, these are the philosophies we see around us. Maybe not with these names to them quite like this, but it's the same idea. The same idea that it's through the material things of this world that's what we live for. Or that everything is determined and that sort of fate and destiny overwhelms us. And so chance overwhelms us all. This is what you see around us today, the same basic philosophies of men that have always been there. And how different is Christianity? Have you ever thought about what life would really be like if you lived it without a belief in God? Without God, there really is no purpose or meaning to life. It's just all chance. It's all just haphazard, sort of. And it's sort of like take pleasures with if you can, sort of the eat, drink, and be merry philosophy. But with God, you have purpose and meaning to your life. Your life has significance. And it's really in great contrast to the things we see around us today. And I think too often, we accept the things around us without really questioning what really is behind them and what really it means to accept the philosophies of the world. So look over with me and look at this sermon that Paul delivers. And it begins in verse 22. Paul stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and he said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship. I even found an altar with an inscription to an unknown God. To what you worship, something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you." Too often in our day and time, God is unknown to us too. Oh, we have lots of fanfare, and it's Christmas season. You see a lot of stuff, you know, little mangers and things. But I wonder how well known God is to our civilization and to our cities and to us. How do we know God? Have you ever thought about how you really know God? The first way we know God is really by His creation. That's Psalms 19 that we read this morning, the beginning of your bulletin. It says, "The heavens declare the glory of God." The very creation that God has given us declares His glory, declares to us who He is. There's many of the psalmists write about the glory of the creation that God has given us. Paul wrote a little bit different, but the same thought in Romans chapter 1. In Romans chapter 1, Paul words it this way. Verse 20, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." And so we see that through the creation, we see God's eternal power, His divine nature, His very glory. And we see the majesty of our God. But how do we determine the personalness of God? How do we determine sort of His personality? Well, how do you determine the personality of anyone? Your friends or your neighbors or anybody else? You determine it by their actions, by what they do and your interaction with them. You get to know people, and by getting to know that person, you learn about that person. God is no different. He has chosen to sort of get to know us. In the Old Testament, there's a scripture that happens many, many times. It's the way God refers to Himself with the children of Israel. He refers to Himself often as, "I am the God that brought you out of Egypt." And that phrase occurs over and over again because God reminds Israel what He has done for them as a people. We serve a God who acts for His people. He didn't just spin up the world and then just walk away and leave it. He's a God that's involved. And He wants to be involved. In fact, we'll see that even more as we go through. Look over to Deuteronomy if you have a Bible. One of the times that this is mentioned, and this was one of the great sermons or speeches by Moses before the children of Israel go into the Promised Land. And Moses reminds the children of all the great things God has done to them, starting it with the plagues in Egypt and the parting of the Red Sea and all the things He had done for them in the wilderness. And in verse 35, He says, "You were shown these things so that you might know that the Lord is God. Beside Him there is no other. From heaven you hear His voice to discipline you. On earth He showed great fire and you heard His words out of the fire. Because He loved your forefathers and chose their descendants after them, He brought you out of Egypt by His presence and His great strength, to drive out before you the nations greater and stronger than you, and to bring you into a land and give you an inheritance." God has taken care of us. He's provided for us, and He continues to. And that's one of the great messages, is how we get to know God is by the way that God has acted for us and how He continues to act for His people and take care of them. But we see that throughout God's plan and how He cared for His people. But now, in these days, is even another way that we learn about God. In Hebrews, in chapter 1, the Hebrew writer brings out another avenue of what we might call special revelation. If you look at the creation of the heavens and the earth as being sort of a general revelation that we know that God is God. In Hebrews 1:1, it refers to that sort of that one-on-one revelation. Here he says, in the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. So God has spoken his words through his prophets and in many different ways. But now, today, in these last days, he's gotten even more personal than that. Before, he gave us his words through his prophets, and that's more personal than just the creation. But now it's one-on-one, so to speak, through Jesus himself. If you look over to the book of John, one of the great themes throughout this whole gospel is that what we might call the personalness of God. In chapter 1 and verse 18, John introduces us to this thought that's going to run through his entire book. In chapter 1:18, he says, "No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known." Jesus has made him known to us today. When Jesus was at the Last Supper, right before he goes to the cross, Philip asked him, "Just show us the Father." And Jesus turned to Philip and says, "Philip, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father." You see, Jesus came to live with us, to be one with us, to talk with us, to feel the same things we feel, so that he could truly show us the love of God. And in 1 John, John says this is love. The love that God had, that he was willing to send his one and only Son for us. So we learn God by the things God has done, the way he's taken care of us, and even the great love that he had when he gave his own Son to die on the cross in our place. So we learn about God, and so we should, as his people, truly know about God. Now listen to how Paul brings this into focus in this great sermon. I'm going to read through the sermon. This week we're only going to really cover the first half. And there's a number of profound things I think you'll see, a little different than what Peter preached on the day of Pentecost. And next week we'll bring the whole sermon into focus. But look with me in verse 24. "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples built by hands. He's not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. For one man he made every nation of men that they should inherit the whole earth, and he determined the times and set them in exact places where they should live. God did this so men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any of us. For in him we live and move and have our very being. As some of your own prophets have said, we are his offspring." Look at how Paul starts his sermon. He starts with the God who made the world and everything in it. He starts it with the creation. Just as a psalmist would write about the great creation, shows us the glory of God, Paul starts this with showing that God is the creator of everything that is. And sometimes we maybe go through that too quickly. You see, the Stoics sort of had the idea that God was everywhere. Very similar to the New Age religion that you read about, that God's in nature and God's this, and that all the world sort of makes up God. That pantheistic idea. Paul brings out the very idea at the very beginning. God created everything. As we've studied before with the great prophecies, it says that the plan that God had for us was before the beginning of time. In other words, God was before time. God was not part of our creation. He is the creator and the sustainer of everything that is. Sometimes we miss the impact of that. We think about that in some of the Greek gods and stuff, they molded things and made things the way they wanted them. God did not mold anything when he created the heavens and the earth. It wasn't like he took all this energy and then made matter out of it. Before God created the universe, there was nothing. He created it from nothing. There was nothing here at all. Time itself, as hard as that is for us to think about, did not exist. That there was nothing, no time. Everything was created by the Creator. And that's what Paul starts this with. And that very thought is really one of the great proofs we have that God himself does exist. Let me relay that. I came across this a few weeks back, and it goes in very well with the very existence of God, because sometimes we take these things too quickly. We don't think about how do we know God, or how do we even know that he exists. But there's three very quick proofs on that. And one is that anything that started to exist had to have a cause. The universe began to exist. So therefore, the universe has a cause outside of itself, which must be God. Now you think about that. Those are very simple little things to think about. Yet it gives you a very valid proof that there is truly a creator God that created the heavens and the earth. The first part of that, anything that begins to exist has a cause. How could the universe begin to exist out of nothing without a cause? Nothing, I mean, if there was nothing here, not even time itself, then there was nothing to cause the universe. Everything that begins to exist had to have a cause. The second part of that is a little bit harder for us in history, and the philosophers agreed, wouldn't have agreed with, that the universe began to exist. Throughout most of civilization, people have looked on the universe as being infinite in time. It's always been here. That's what the Greek philosophers, Aristotle and Plato, taught. But in the last couple hundred years, through science, if you even, of course, the Bible itself told us in the very beginning, the all you had to do is read the very first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But if you just look at the history that we have now over the last 100 years, we've learned that our universe had to have a beginning. There's one proof, I won't go through it, it's very difficult for me to understand. But you can actually show that nothing infinite can exist in our universe. I had a trouble with that one because all the way through college, I always used infinity in a lot of mathematical proofs, and we would integrate things to infinity. But anything infinite cannot actually exist in our universe, and you can actually go through and prove that. But if you look at the next two proofs, they're even more valid to where we are. And the next one is that we live in an expanding universe. And that means that if you look at any star in the sky, all of them are moving away from us. Hubble, over 100 years, discovered that with his telescope. And it's why the Hubble telescope that's in space now was named after him. Because he looked at the stars on this side and that side, they were all moving away. And he came to the conclusion that the whole universe was expanding. And later on, then Einstein came up with his theory of general relativity that explained that even further. And that things have been tested over and over again by science, that we learned that our universe truly is expanding in all directions. And by expanding in all directions, if you go through that thought, you can actually prove that it had to have a beginning. It had to have a finite beginning. It could not have always been. And there's probably nothing in science now that's been tested more than Einstein's theories and those things that go along with the idea that we live in an expanding universe. But there's a third way to look at that show that our universe must have had a beginning. And this is one that even people that may not want to go through Einstein's theories, and that's what's called the second law of thermodynamics. And that simply means that all systems run down. And we can just watch anything, and you know that that happens. You drive your car today, and it doesn't run quite as good as it did 10 years ago if you continue to run it. Every system runs down in time. And actually, that means all systems together would, over time, run down. If you walk into a room, everything will eventually be in equilibrium. And that simply means if you walk in the room, you don't have to worry that all the air went to this side and there's a vacuum over here. All the air will be equal in pressure. That goes along with, in time, the entire universe will be equal in pressure, equal in temperature. Everything would run down. Now, it would take a long time, and I'm not saying any of us would be around when that would happen. But if you could just have a trillion, billion, or whatever years, eventually the universe would run down just like everything else runs down. And so we know the universe has not always been. It had to have a beginning. And we know that, of course, that beginning was the Creator God. So if all systems that Anything that has been had to have a cause. And if the universe had a beginning, then that beginning has to be the Creator God. So there is good reason, even in science today, to realize that the belief in God is firm and that there's proofs for these things and that we can be sure of what we have believed. But Paul doesn't end there. That's really where he starts. He starts with the idea that God is the creator of heaven and earth, and then he goes into the idea that God doesn't need anything from us because he's the creator. Have you ever wondered why we come together and worship? I once had a person ask me, why does God need us to worship him? Why does he need us to sing songs to him and to give him gifts? And why does he need any of this? He doesn't. That's what Paul brings out. Who needs worship? We need to worship. You see, each one of us need to worship God. We have a hole in our existence if we don't fill it with our God. Worship is not for God. Worship is for us. It's to bring us together as a people and bring us into relationship with God. And that's what Paul brings out. The next thing he brings out is also something that you need to think about. He brings out the idea that all races came from one man. Notice how he words this. He says he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives men life and breath and everything. And from one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth and determine the times and set them the exact places where they should live. Now that's also a very profound thing to think about, how that should affect us. He's really saying that all the world is made up of all these different races. But there's no race better than any other race, because we all came from the same. We're all basically kin to each other. And so we shouldn't think one race is better than another race or one people better than another people, because we're really all the same. And that's what he brings us to, that we all came from the same man that God created. And so there's no real difference in any of us. But then he goes to the next part, and this is the thing I want you to really think about that he says. He spread all these people over all the world. If you look over Deuteronomy 32, again, Moses gives us much the same thought. In Deuteronomy 32, Moses says these words. And I'm going to read this out of our text. Most of the time, Paul quoted out of the Greek text, which is slightly different. In Deuteronomy 32, Moses wrote, "When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, he divided up all mankind and set up boundaries of the people according to the number of the sons of Israel," or the Greek translation, "the sons of God." That God is the one that moved everybody and moved everybody around and basically set up the world like it is, giving us everything that we need, as he says. He gives us everything we need. He gave us all of this as an inheritance. Why? And I think the next verse, to me, is one of the most profound thoughts in all the scriptures. Listen to what Paul says, why God did all of this. He says, "God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him, though he is not far from each one of us." Now you think about what he's saying. He's saying that God created the heavens and the earth, everything that is, even time itself. God created all that. Then he created this earth like we have it, and he placed men here, or mankind, people, all over the earth, and he gave them everything they needed. Why? So that we could have a relationship with him. Now you think about that. This creator of heaven and earth, Almighty God himself, wants to have a relationship with you. He wants to have a personal relationship. He wants you to seek him. Now you think about that. He did all of this for you, even giving his son on the cross. Not just so he could sit back and just watch everything, but so that he could be with you. That he could seek a relationship with you. That's what God did all of this for. And to me, the more I think about that, the more it's just almost hard for my mind to take it in. That God doesn't look down on us as a group of people, but he looks down on us and he wants to know each one of us as an individual. He wants you to seek him as he has sought you. And he's done all these things so that you will seek him. Think about today where you are in your life's journey, how you look upon the things of this world and what you seek after. And know that there is a God that wants to know you as a person. He wants to have a relationship with you. He wants you to have a relationship with him. In other words, this creator of heaven and earth that's all powerful thinks that you are important. And that's the difference between Christianity and all other thoughts anywhere in the world. Because everything else basically tells you that life doesn't make much difference and that life doesn't have much value. But Christianity lets you know that the creator of heaven and earth, the greatest being that we can even imagine, thinks that each one of us is important, wants to have a relationship with us. And that is something for you to think about. And it hopefully will make you think about to reach out to him. This morning, are you reaching out to God? Have you truly listened to him? Because he has made himself known. First through the creation, then through the prophets, and now in these later days through Jesus himself. He's made himself known for each one of us. And he wants you to have that relationship. If you haven't put Jesus on in baptism, being united in that greatest act that God ever did in sending his own son, the great act of love, when you're buried with him in baptism, you unite yourself with Christ. So that as he arose from the grave, you too arise from the water of baptism to walk with him. If you've never done that, why not do that? Or if you've started your walk with him, but you really haven't been faithful to it, you've never really thought about what he has done for you, why not think about that today so that you can truly seek after your Lord and your Father and your God? If you have need to come in any way, won't you come as together we stand and sing?